Welcome back to the Sketchy Boys Watch Club podcast. I'm joined today by Andreas, the marketing director for Fortis. Andreas, welcome to the show, sir.
Hi, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Let's start it with the wrist check. What do you got on?
Today I'm wearing one of the very few Novonaut first editions. So recently redone the official Cosmonaut, transformed it into the Novonaut, and we did a limited series of 100 pieces for the first edition, like a little special for the start.
Very neat. And Fortis has a very cool history that we're going to get into. I'm excited today because Fortis is actually the oldest brand that I've had on the podcast thus far.
Oh,
So
nice.
we'll get into that, but let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Start with childhood up to what you're doing now.
All right, that far. Okay. So I grew up in Germany and went to school in Germany. I went to boarding school in Germany. I did my studies in Germany. I did study economics and graduated that in, what is it, 2008 or something? I think, yeah, 2008 or 2009. I can't remember. And then I started working in a media agency doing all the media advertising for a very large grocery store or chain store in Germany, which is called Edeka, maybe some of them. And then also did all the advertising or media plannings for Jägermeister, that you for sure know. And then 3 years later, I left that company and moved to the south of Germany with my wife and started being the head of marketing for GameStop for the Swiss, Austrian, and German stores. That's been around 250 stores at that time. And like 2 or 3 years later, I got a call from Fortis CEO at that time if I would be willing to join Fortis as head of sales. And yeah, I couldn't deny that offer. So that's how it all started. Like that's now 10 years ago, 10 and a half, you know.
And were you into watches growing up?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I had a watch, you know, it's like I had, you know, my mom and dad, they once gave me a Fossil watch for Christmas or something, like back in the days, like when I was 14 or 15 or something. But I never really cared about watches until then. But now, for more than a decade now, I'm heavily into watches. So yeah, I guess you get addicted at some point.
It's funny how many of us, myself included, started with Fossil watches
Yeah,
as teenagers.
it's a really good kind of starting point, I guess. There's like, yeah, I mean, obviously then there was the follow-up with the G-Shock and Baby G's and whatsoever. But to wear a proper watch, I mean, that's what I started at Fortis.
And you mentioned you went to boarding school.
Yeah.
That's certainly less common here in the States. Well, what's that like? Can you describe that experience?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's not something very common in Germany or in Europe in general. It's like, on the one hand, it's something very elite, and on the other hand, it's something for people who are really bad in school. And that was, I'm more group B now. So I was really bad in school, and you know, I was more on my skateboard than in school, basically. So at some point my parents said, "We cannot help you this way." So they sent me to boarding school, and like they said, "You can come back on the weekend." So, but then the first weekend came, and I said, "Listen, mom, I'm not coming home because it's good fun."
And then you said that the CEO of Fortis was the one that reached out to you. How did that happen?
That's actually quite a family story because my dad knew the CEO of Fortis. They've been working together in China and some other businesses. And the CEO was looking for somebody new doing the sales. They were just trying to putting back Fortis into its place, and they were looking for people they could trust, people they do hard work and that kind of stuff. So they got me into play, and that's how it all came. Yeah. So yeah, it's basically a family thing. So, and then I stayed after Jupp took over the company. So he
Understood.
calls me inventory.
Let's talk now about Fortis then.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is going to be the oldest company that I've had on the podcast. Can you get into the history of Fortis for us?
Yes, sure. First and foremost, what I can highly recommend, whatever If ever there's one of those, one of your listeners in Switzerland, there is a link on our website. If you want to visit the manufacturing, you just click on that link, you fill it out, and then we make sure we get you covered in-house. So you get the full story. So Fortis was found 1912 by Walter Vogt. He already knew like 1909 that the rail tracks were built just at that place. And he knew, if I want to expand that company to an international brand, we need to be able to basically ship the watches fast throughout the world. And that's why he basically built the building next to the station in Grenchen. So that's why it's there. And we're still there, very same building. We obviously completely renovated and refurbished the whole inside to, let's say, modern demands of watchmaking. So the idea of Walter Vogt in 1912 was to build robust watches that are, let's say, not out of this world in terms of pricing, that are affordable, but actually for the, let's say, hardworking people. And in 1926, or before that, I mean, you could maybe remember John Harwood. He's one of the very famous figures in watchmaking. In 1924, he kind of invented the first automatic wristwatch movement, and he patented it. And the idea was that by only moving the hand, you can basically wind the movement. And Walter Vogt, he very much liked that idea, because at that time, gaskets and all of that, they were literally non-existent or very bad. And there was always an issue with the crown pulling it out like every single day, setting the time, wind it. And there was always dust and moisture and whatsoever going into the movement, which kind of destroys it at a certain point in time. So the idea was, Walter Vogt said, we need to get rid of the crown, because the crown is an issue. It kind of is not very robust. It's not very purposeful. And he liked the idea of John Harwood. So they sat together and basically they brought out the first automatic wristwatch in 1926. That was July 13, which is quite funny because we still have the 13 being kind of an Easter egg for Fortis nowadays. And it was at the same year where there was the Basel World Watch Fair, and we shared a table with Omega. That was the size at that time. So nowadays it's obviously a different story. But that time they invented something that kind of made history in whatever horological aspect. So the automatic wristwatch is something that's never been done before. And I mean, nowadays, it's like probably 90% of the watches are automatic wristwatches. And we are quite proud of that, that we are still building our watches in the very, very same room. So if you come there, you can feel the spirit of, you know, two genius people sticking their heads together and building the first automatic wristwatch. And that's 100 years to this year. So that's very good and cool for us. Yeah, then later, obviously, if you go through the decades, I'm not going to go too much into detail, but if you go through the decades, we had crazy times with, for example, the flipper watches. That's been in the 60s and 70s, where we've had the first plastic container quartz watch, which then a year or 2 years later was basically done by Swatch, and they still do it today. So that's another like big milestone. We had two more buildings, done more than a million watches a year. In 1954, we had the first Marine Master. The idea was to basically have a very water-resistant watch. I don't know exact dates, but I think Rolex and Omega, they did their dive watches, Submariner in 53 or something. So it's around about the same date when it comes to technical innovations. It's basically like, this is like the beginning of the true, let's say, tool watch chapter. Mm-hmm. And then they developed it further to, you know, supporting pilots, supporting NASA Gemini astronauts, supporting the Russian cosmonauts at the time and other cosmonauts. And we are more than 30 years now in space. We are doing pilot watches for more than 40 years. And the very good thing about it is that we're still independent, still in the very same building. And, you know, that's a value not many brands kind of have left. And that's what we really love about Fortis. Yeah.
I like that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but since the early 90s, Fortis has been the supplier for the Russian Federal Space Agency.
Yeah, we used to be that. Nowadays, there's obviously no more contact, I think, since 2014 or something. But we're working on the future when it comes to space.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the past, we know pretty sure that Fortis has done more than 150,000 orbits inside and outside the stations, multiple thousands of hours in EVA situations, even abused as a hammer. You know, that kind of stuff, the stories are really crazy. I mean, there's some good footage on YouTube, if you Google for it, or YouTube for it. It's our legacy, basically, that we kind of brought into the new Novonaut, where we are working on new projects with new partners, mainly in Europe at the moment, with the Swedish Space Corporation. They do test our movements. We test them in space and in the stratosphere. And because our approach to space was never like, oh, there is a watch in space, let's do the space story. Our idea was always, since the very start, to build the watch for space, to basically have a checklist of requirements by space agencies that we need to fulfill. And that makes Fortis, let's say, the most tested space watch, if you want. So people always ask me, yeah, but I'm not an astronaut. Why do I need that? And I say, yeah, you're not an astronaut, but whatever is tested for space is going to survive whatever you do. So if you have a look at the vibrations when the rocket launches or the G-forces, et cetera, the water resist, I mean, 18 hours per day, they train within water. So it better is water resistant, right? If you ride your mountain bike downhill, the vibration is crazy, right? So we test this to space requirements so that you are very safe and sound in your daily life.
The timing of this interview is kind of cool because just this past weekend, I interviewed NASA astronaut Dan Birch, and we had the Artemis II launch recently, the successful mission and return of those astronauts. So it's cool that Fortis has that background tied in space.
Yeah.
And if you missed the episode with Dan Birch, go ahead and give it a listen because he was actually gifted an Omega Speedmaster by the Russians that he took up to the International Space Station. But it would have been cool if you got a Fortis instead, I guess.
It's never too late, you know? I mean, you never know what happens in space. And I know that there is a lot of legacy history to the Speedmaster, and I do like the Speedmaster very much. And I mean, it's at the end of the day, we don't have that marketing power like an Omega has. That's how simple it is. I mean, I cannot afford George Clooney. So, I mean, the continuous story of being in space and, you know, tested for space, I think there's two different approaches. You know, Omega has been on the moon, has very nice stories. But, you know, if it comes to build for something, I would guess in terms of toughness, I would maybe go for a Novonaut nowadays. But yeah.
And since you did bring up, you can't afford George Clooney, we were talking a little bit offline and I got to ask this question. With Fortis, certain models being at the price point of Tudor and Omega, and with this podcast primarily being focused on the military law enforcement adventurer, I'll tell you this, sometimes this corner of the market gets a little tied up in name brands and recognizability. Yeah. What would you kind of say to someone who says, well, at that price point, I could just get a Tudor and Omega? And how would you kind of sell Fortis to that user?
I mean, yes, of course. You know, most of the time people tell you for that price point, I could get a Tudor. They don't even buy the Tudor. So that, to be honestly said. And I know that I like Tudor. I like Omega, very cool brands. The question you've got to ask yourself is if that's the most important thing for you, that it says Tudor or Omega on the dial or Breitling. You know, if that's not the case, right? And you're looking for value, purpose-built performance, then you might end up with a Fortis and have something different, which you can talk through with your friends, you know, because they all have the Tudor. He's got Tudor, he's got the Tudor, and they're all named Black Bass. And maybe you're the one with the Novonaut or the Moraine Master, having something special on the table. I mean, in terms of quality, we don't need to hide here. This is like minimum at the same level and sometimes even beyond. So I think that if, like, let's say the brand size is important to you, yeah, then what can I do, right? So, but if like true quality or like values, like family owned, if you call in at Fortis, yes, I can put you through and you get Yup on the line. Try to do this at Tudor, right? Mm-hmm. We are very close knit with our customers. So if ever there's a problem, yeah, just simply call, send an email. We get this fixed, right? Or if you need something special, yes, we can do that. If you want something like personally engraved, or if you have any idea, yeah, come around, have a look at it, right? So it's not a like a vault where there's a brand in sight and they, you know, spit out products and then, you know, that's what you get. So our idea is a bit more like the true core values of what a tool, what should be. That's how I would put it.
And one of the things that I love about doing this podcast is getting to connect with brands like you, where, as I said, sometimes cops and military guys get a little caught up in the flex, if you want to call it that. Yeah. And I'll tell this story. I had a major in my Army unit that would actually carry around his receipts from his Rolexes. It was a weird thing, but like I said, sometimes the flex or the appearance overshadows everything else. And what I love about this podcast is sharing brands and their stories and the people behind them with end users who are taking these watches into harm's way. And for a lot of the people that have given me feedback on this podcast, it's that the brands that I've had on, they didn't even know about. And now they start looking into it because they're getting more into watchmaking and understanding the history behind the brand rather than just the name brand recognition.
Yeah, so absolutely.
And I love that you're able to tell me all this and tell me about being in the same shop for the last 100 years and all that.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, I mean, that's something, you know, the Americans and the Canadians probably as well, is love for the, let's say, underdog, right? Mm-hmm,
absolutely.
For the guy, every single Hollywood movie goes through that scenario, right? The guy who's the underdog, you know, growing, becoming more well-known or getting the credibility and everything from its consumers, right? Or from the people who've watched the movie. So that the idea is, yes, you could go the easy way, take a Tudor because your friend said so, or you dig into it and go for something special. I mean, even with Tudor, I mean, you name it, we're using the same movement. There's no quality issues or whatever. So there's nothing against Tudor or Fortis, right? So when I think about this kind of topic, is for me really important is brand more than 50% of the reason why you buy something, or is it other values, right? So then you got to dig into something. You know, it's easy to buy a Rolex because it's a safe buy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a clue if you buy a Rolex most of the time, right? Because Rolex should be good, right? Check. No, you got to dig into and see, oh, Fortis isn't that bad. But actually, it's very good. Oh, maybe I go for a Fortis. And then you realize, nice. There's more stuff than the big five out there. So
Yeah, and I would say that someone having a Fortis is an immediate clue to me that that person's actually a legitimate watch enthusiast. Yeah. And we're going to have a good conversation.
Absolutely.
Just frankly speaking, sometimes when you see a Rolex, sorry, I'm just going to use that example, and you start talking to the person, they don't even know anything about the watch that they bought. They just bought it because it's a Rolex, right?
Yeah. Buy a different crown, I always tell them. It's like, I think, you know, and to be fair, Rolex owns this place, right? Mm. So, I mean, what they did, I always tell the people, listen, if everything goes to plan, Fortis is like Rolex in the 50s. So the idea is to get more and more credibility and support from a community and to grow this brand into something iconic, right? So I don't want to sell a million or even more than a million watches a year. I mean, our maxed out limit is 10,000 watches a year. Mm-hmm. So that's how limited we are as a brand. And we don't want to outgrow this number because that doesn't make sense for us, right? So then we no longer will be a family-owned business anymore. You know, now it's kind of, there's, I think, 25 people in the factory, some people around in the different countries, but that's it, right? I mean, Rolex has 8,000 employees. Mm-hmm. It's a different story, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, you earn the credibility by building a very good, reliable product mm-hmm. and being a very customer-orientated brand with an open door where people come around, have a look at you, check out. And I think this is something we want to keep for like ever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, go try yourself, knock some doors in Biel. You won't.
And you mentioned sizing as far as the company size and how many watches you guys are making every year. What's the plan? I know you said you don't want to overdo it, but what's the plan for growth?
I mean, obviously, at the moment, we're doing about 2,500 watches a year with 4 watchmakers. So that's also kind of a difference. If you check out other companies, there's like one watchmaker doing 300 watches a week. Mm-hmm. So that's not our goal. Our idea is you build the watch until it's perfect. And if you need to do it again, you do it again. But yes, our plan, our midterm plan is to grow the American market. We are quite strong in Germany already. Historically wise, that's been always like that. And we're trying to expand our presence in the US. I know that it's very difficult at the moment to get your hands on a watch, but we're working on that. There's some very interested shops and dealers already looking into it. And I think there's going to be a huge step within the next 12 months in terms of visibility.
I'm going to interrupt you really quick.
Yeah, sure.
We do have a Wind Up Watch Fair in San Francisco coming up very soon. Are you going to be there for that?
We did wind ups in the past, mm-hmm. but from our brand perspective, we kind of outgrew this kind of people that visit that fair without being any mean or something, but it just doesn't make sense anymore. It's been good for a start to see what kind of people are around and stuff like that. But you'll find us at the Watch Time show in New York in October. And that's basically it for the year. And the problem is if you grow the brand into a certain direction, you gotta kind of educate the right people into that direction too, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense to convince someone who has $1,000 for a watch to invest $5,000. He's not gonna do that, right? Because he simply doesn't have it, or he might not wanna spend it, whatever the reason is. So we rather go to a watch fair where people are used to spending 10,000, 20,000 grand on a watch. And we're basically the product, like the takeaway product in that case. So, and they kind of value more the brand, let's say, being an underdog brand in this, let's say, very scary environment of big brands showing where the dead end is.
I got to say, Wind Up was actually what put Fortis on my radar a number of years ago. Yeah. So that was cool to see that in person and get to try on some of the watches. Mm. So I will be out there. I generally record podcasts a few weeks out and then publish them later. So this will probably be dropping the Monday after Wind Up.
Okay.
So, but
yeah, I mean, I would never say that we're not never going back to Wind Up because we love the people. We love the people who kind of set this all up. Big shout out to One and Wound, Kyle and everyone, Nelly. It's really, it's like a, you know, like a family event every time. It's mm-hmm. like literally all the brands we meet like 3 or 4 times a year there. So we never meet at home. We only meet on wind-ups, which is always a good fun. But at the end of the day, we kind of outgrown the pockets, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you're always the most expensive, you know, by far brand in the room, it's difficult to, and you're kind of doing the same discussions over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. Why is it so expensive? Yes, because this is a Kennedy movement. This is not a Celita movement, mm-hmm. right? And then you start doing all the discussions over and over again, which I love to do. But at the moment in time right now, we don't need this kind of discussion. We need to tell them, yeah, you could buy the Tudor, but you could also buy the Fortis. So that's more the kind of discussion you want to kind of have at the moment. So, but yeah, I would never say we're not going back because we really loved it. And why not? Yeah.
It's always interesting to me to hear different brands explain their reasoning for not going, because I've had a number of different brands tell me that they're not coming this year. And for some people, it's a cost thing where they don't want to spend that much money to maybe sell a couple of watches where they're at the lower price point. But then you're kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum, which is kind of funny to me. And it's funny that we're having that conversation that to a degree that you have with some of the people at Windup and explaining the price point.
Yeah, it's not just that, you know, it's like, obviously it's, you know, if you want to do it properly, you need to be 2 to 3 people. You need to travel there. I mean, you spend a lot of time, a lot of money, and we were never about, you know, putting sales at the, you know, event at the top of our mm-hmm. minds. It's more getting the word out, who we are, what we are, get your hands on, blah, 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 all of that. But it's never been like, oh, we need to sell watches to pay the fare. So right. That's never been our point. Because if that was my point, right, I would stop doing everything because that wouldn't make sense at all.
Sure.
So our idea is to present ourselves, to tell the story about Fortis. I mean, there's lots of people who haven't heard about Fortis who still think Fortis is a German brand. Yes, it's not. You know, stuff like that where we want to kind of clarify what kind of things we build, collections we have, movements, et cetera, et cetera. And all the values that we kind of stand for. So yeah, I like Windup very much. I would love to go there like every single Windup, every single time, have cool drinks and stuff and good watch talks. But for the brand at the moment, that doesn't make sense. So, but we're still working with Windup. We're still working with One Amount on different other projects. And yeah, if people want to come around and get your hands on, you're highly welcome to New York in October. I think there is a Windup too, so why not pop into the other fair as well?
And let's go back. You talked a little bit about the testing that mm-hmm. goes into these. Can you talk a little bit more and to kind of explain to people how rigorous it is and what actually happens in those tests?
So basically, to understand what we test, you need to understand where our kind of definition or standards come from. The whole standards that we are testing to come from the SSC, which is the Swedish Space Corporation. We've been working with them now for the past 6-7 years, something like that. And they are based in Stockholm, but also in very north of Sweden, close to the beyond the polar circle even. And what they do there is they do stratospheric balloon tests and rocket testing. So what we did in the first place was to test the movements themselves in the open stratosphere, which is, yes, not 100% space, but that's as close as you can get to space. So we've been around 34 kilometers in altitude, minus 65 or 67 degrees in Celsius, and going through gusty winds and, you know, quite harsh conditions. There were wind speeds up to 250 kilometers per hour. And all the prototype, let's say, watch cases, they were equipped with what you call these like little sensors and everything that basically captured all the data of the environment, but also the ticking of the movement. And then we had to cut the balloon because if we wouldn't have done that, we wouldn't have got it back in Russia, which would be an issue. So because Earth kind of turns gusty winds into the other direction. So we started in Sweden and we picked it up in Finland. So there's a nice documentary on YouTube if you want to watch that. And that was the first round of, let's say, requests that you would have on a movement regarding to capabilities or what it, you know, should take.
Really quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, sure.
So this test itself, who does all the planning and the coordination? I would assume that the watchmakers are not calculating where they need to make the cut. I'm assuming the space folks are doing that.
It's first and foremost, it's a trial and error, right? You're doing something someone has never done before. No one ever tested a watch that deep on the stratosphere. So our idea was, okay, we put up 13 watches being our lucky number. So we set those 13 watches on a gondola with different lubrication, different, you know, having the chronograph running, not running, this and that, different stuff that the watchmakers kind of wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And the Swedish Space Corporation basically tells us what's going to happen, but they don't know 100%, right? So then later, when you get back the data, you basically find out temperatures, gravity, G-forces, all of that, you know, wind speeds. And I mean, a wind speed doesn't even make sense maybe, but I mean, if there's drag in the air or something, that makes maybe sense for a movement at some point if you are a base jumper or I don't know, right? So all of these kind of data and information goes into our testing in our own test facilities then. So, and then on the second run, we've had it on the rocket. The rocket flew up to 260 kilometers. And there were 12 other experiments on board, and they were all looking for the microgravity up there. And we knew microgravity is no issue at all. We've done this for the past 30 years. That's tick the box, right? But the things we wanted to know is the frequency of vibration it goes through when the rocket launches, the G-force that it pulls, the speed, the acceleration. And, you know, the rocket comes back like with its back first, if you want so. So it literally just, you know, going in, it ramps into the ground with, what was it, 40 kilometers per hour or something. It's like a really bad hit, right? Like mm-hmm. if you crash your car. And out of those data, you know, there were 13 watches mounted in there. And out of this data, we wanted also to know how can we test this? And because obviously none of us, or at least only one out of a million, maybe will sooner or later experience that kind of stuff. But for that one, we can say, yes, we've done that. And it's a very interesting thing because, as I mentioned earlier, why do I need this in a watch, right? Yes, and I say, if you go down with your downhill bike, there's a lot of vibration on your bike. I mean, even if you go motorcycling and you just are on the road and it shakes your wrists and stuff. So we've tested it from 0 to 20,000 hertz. So this is like one of the things the watch must go through. We had it during liftoff. There were 13 G, which we've done before in aviation and everything. But on the way back, it was minus 26. So yeah. So we need to find out, can it take that, right? Same with water resistance. Yeah, you know, we know that the astronauts, I mean, we have the test results from like 30 years ago with the Roscosmos project, where they are 18 hours underwater, you know, kind of like simulating the, at that time, Mir missions, you know, working mm-hmm. on the station underwater and everything to mm-hmm. kind of simulate zero gravity. So the watch needs to be water resistance, like nothing else, right? So that's why all our watches are at least 200 meters water resistant. I mean, we have a test machine that can go down to 1,250 meters. The Marine Master, I mean, we put it in, we close it, and it's a manual pressure that you add, basically. It's like a submarine, basically, where you add pressure. And the Marine Master wasn't affected by 1250. So, yeah, that's impressive. How far we can take it, right? And I think at the moment, they are our operations manager, Marcel. He is taking care of all the testing environments and everything. He is at the moment developing, together with the SSC, a new machine that's never existed before that can actually test G-forces and spin and vibration in once, like own test machines, because there is no such machine on the planet. So we need to kind of, you know,
come up with something.
Yeah. So we call it the chamber of pain in Grenchen.
Nice.
Because what we want to do in that room is to break the watch, because we want to know when it breaks. That's the next kind of thing the way we kind of try to figure out how robust is it. Like, it starts from the movement, it goes further to the sapphires, it goes to screws, the bracelets. I mean, there's 40 kilo torsion tests on the bracelet, the clasp must not open, stuff like that. There's 60,000 times you will push the pusher. Ridiculous. You're not going to do this like in two lives. So I mean, if you're not a nerd, right? But yeah, that's the kind of stuff we do.
And I'm sure at some point during prototyping, stuff breaks, and that's, you're looking for that limit. What usually, what are the failures that you see?
I mean, we had this, like, for example, on the block bracelet. That's a very easy to explain thing we found out is, in like the very first prototypes, the screw of the links was screwed into the link, right? So we had it on we call it a machine that kind of does the wear and tear simulation. And basically what happened was the screws came out. So by the, let's say, force of the movement, the screw itself got out or drew itself out. I don't know how you put this in English, but
started walking out.
Yeah, exactly. So we changed it to now you need two screwdrivers to change it, but now it's a free floating screw. So it's basically, it's loose inside the block bracelet.
Yeah, so it can't walk out.
Because of its looseness, it's not going to move into the contra direction, right? Yeah. So stuff like that, yeah.
That's awesome that you guys are finding those limits instead of letting end users find them.
Yeah, that's something we said. No, it's not the customer telling us it's breaking. I mean, by all means, we are only humans. Things will happen, right? And if you are very rude and take a hammer out, and you know, you will crash the watch, yeah, right? Don't get me wrong. But in a, let's say, regular use, or even if you are doing like tough jobs, nothing's going to happen, right? That's what we do.
And I'm going to kind of transition topics just a little bit here. I frequently get hit up by people in my circles, meaning military and law enforcement, saying, hey, I want to buy my first quote unquote real watch. Generally, it goes through the progression. Hey, they had a Fossil watch as a kid, and then they got a Seiko, and they're saying, hey, I just made detective, or I just got on the SWAT team. I want something to celebrate. And they're looking at this price point. What is your recommendation for military or law enforcement dudes from your lineup?
It's very easy in one sentence. It's basically the nicest watch for the toughest jobs. No matter if you're working on an oil rig or if you are captain of a crab catching ship, if you are, you know, what's these guys called in Montana, like the guys who jump into fire. It doesn't matter, right? You know, at one point, they move from being the co-worker into the, let's say, boardroom, and they need to switch from Ulrich to boardroom and back and forth, a bit like Landman, you know, the guy who has worked very hard and drops into a new position and wants to treat himself with something really good that takes a hit, that can get scratched, you know, that kind of, we're not shiny, right? You don't need that, oh, I made it, I need a 18K rose gold, whatever, Daytona. You want something that's still says, I'm part of your team and I'm part of your team, right? So, and I think that's like the main claim for us. I mean, if you want something like that, what you just said, yes, you could go for the names. That's what we discussed already. But if you want something who does the job, yeah, go get a Fortis.
Do you have a specific model that you recommend people look at?
So interestingly enough is we have 5 collections, right? So, and what we always say is like every single collection is kind of unique and not a copycat of any other watch brands that we've seen so often, right? So no matter if it's the Flieger, the Marine Master, Novonaut, Stratoliner, or Vagabond, all of these are unique positioned collections with a clear personality that buys that, right? But what we always say is every single person has like multiple personalities in itself. So at some point, I am, let's say, the Novonaut guy, you know, being the guy who's curious, building stuff, you know, kind of, we call him the engineer, basically. He's like the engineering dude. Then you have a Stratoliner, for example. That's kind of the Richard Branson dude, right? And the engineer dude builds the spacecraft for Richard Branson. So that's kind of how it works. Then you have the Vagabond, who is basically the first tool watch for the traveler. Because we said, yes, there's a lot of GMTs out there, but the idea to put something, the tool watch, into a new perspective in terms of being the tool to remind you that you have family and kids at home is like, that's the tool. Yeah. And you have that one sports tool watch that goes with you when you're abroad, having a second time zone, and you have your home time with a 18 karat gold, white gold ring. That's only for you. That's not kind of a prestige show off whatever thing. It's only for you to remind you that the most important time zone is home, wherever you are. So, and same with the Flieger. The Flieger is super functional, right? That's for the doers, right? Hands-on guys. And the Marine Master, I mean, the Marine Master is the ultimate tool watch if you want. So it can go anywhere, do anything, right? It's not getting any tougher than that. Even if, especially in the new, let's say, DLC versions we've just released. So yeah, I mean, there's something for everyone, right?
Mm-hmm. I like that. And how does your marketing for each one of those personalities change? How do you see yourself marketing to those personalities? I guess it's a question.
That's a good question. Actually, because it's difficult to separate the collections from each other in terms of marketing, because, mm-hmm. you know, we don't have like the Breitling budgets or Tudor budgets to say, okay, let's do something like for $1 million here and $1 million there. We don't have that, right? You always need to remember it's a family-owned business. It's Yop's private money. So what we do is, the main idea is tool watch redefined, because we want to be the new definition of what a tool watch should be, right? It's not about brand name. It's about the brand value. It's about the capabilities. It's about the way we build things, the way we test things. If you like family owned, if you like space tested, if you like maybe a bit the underdog situation, if you want to be that one besides your 10 colleagues wearing a Speedmaster, being the one having the Fortis, you have the story, because they can always tell the same story, right? That's where we come in, and where we say, okay, it doesn't matter. Actually, of course, there's campaigns to each collection. Like we have the Vagabond, where we have people, you know, we did a very nice video for YouTube with Benny Grape, who is a drummer traveling the world, who needs a GMT watch. We have for every single collection, we have like brand ambassadors that are basically in-house, because we work with people who we trust that we don't need to pay first and then do something. So, but they just kind of stand for a certain collection or idea behind the collection. So our camera guy is the Novonok guy. You know, so he's curious. He always wants to know how to fix this, how to get this solved, how to do this. Then we have a pilot from Grenchen, who is our basically the personal pilot. He's the Flieger guy, obviously. Then we have a free diver from Germany, which we know very long, who's doing our, who's the face for our marine master. And for the Stratoliner, for example, we're working with our designer, Xavier Pernoux. He is also the designer for Armin Strom and some of the, I think, Audemars Piguet models. So the idea is to work with people that are very close to you because you understand them, right? And you want to understand your customer, you know? I know that a lot of people want to be George Clooney or Brad Pitt, but they're never going to be George Clooney or Brad Pitt, right? So basically, they're just the guy next door and he wants a nice, tough watch. So that's why we say two watch redefined. And especially in the US, the idea of there is a lot of hardworking people doing tough jobs. Yes, you want a nice watch? Here we are. That's it.
I like what you talked about. I'm going to put it this way. Part of the reason why I bought my Seamaster, for example, is because I grew up seeing James Bond. And that's actually the case for a lot of people in this industry. But at the end of the day, I'm not James Bond. I'm not George Clooney. And one of my passions for running this podcast is I genuinely believe that everyone has a story. And make your own one worth telling and always be willing to hear someone else's. And I think that finding a brand that is not just the brand and has its own identity. And that's not to say that these brands that we've kind of mentioned don't have, there's a reason why they're there, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's also a point that now people buy only for the brand instead of doing their own research and finding something that has a story and blending that into their own story, right? And that's what I love about doing this podcast is getting to talk to brands, because Rolex is not going to talk to me on this podcast.
No.
Right? Let's be real. But this is exactly the type of backstory for a brand that I want to get out, because this industry is very hard on equipment.
Oh, yeah.
And this is exactly the type of brand that needs to be on their radar.
Yeah. I mean, and it's shifting. I mean, we can see a shift from like in the 90s, 2000s, people were even harder looking for brand, right? Mm-hmm. So, and now we can see kind of a shift. The new gen, you know, I always tell the people the money is always the same because you guys inherited from your parents, they inherited from their parents, but their vision of how to spend the money is different. So the amount is the same, right? But the generation and their mindset changes. So if you look at this from a boomer perspective, right? You say, okay, maybe a boomer is someone who buys a Rolex just because it says Rolex, right?
Right.
But then Gen Z buys a Rolex because of completely different reasons. And then what is it? Alpha doesn't even buy a Rolex maybe, right? So, and that's how the money kind of transforms into different brands over the time. And I think at the moment we are in a time where people are considering, let's say, smaller brands, or I always call them exclusive brands, but it's smaller brands basically, but they want the same quality or better. So they don't want to miss out on quality because that's a nightmare, right? So you want the same quality or even better, and you're looking for something special. A Rolex is nothing special anymore. I mean, yes, people tell me, yeah, but you cannot buy them. They don't have it in stock. You need to put it on a waiting list. Yes, you do. Mm-hmm. That's not even a lie. That's not even a lie. They build 1.5 million watches a year. How many people do want a Rolex a year? It's not possible to serve them. Mm-hmm. The thing is, you're not something special with a Rolex anymore. So I think being at that, at the moment, 2,500, maybe in 5 years, 6,000, maybe in 10 years, 10,000 watches, you're buying something exclusive, something special. You can be part of the story of Fortis, right? And I think people really appreciate the close-knit thing here, the being part of something, right? You're not part of Rolex when you buy a Rolex. If you buy a Fortis, you're part of Fortis. But in the moment you put your cash down, you're part of the game, right? You are my ambassador then, right? I want you to tell your friends that you bought a nice watch for tough jobs. That's what you should do. So yeah.
I like that a lot. You talked a little bit about the shift in the consumer. How have you seen Fortis shift over the years?
Oh, I'm glad to start. So, I mean, the easiest approach I can probably do is when you look at Fortis back in the 2000s, right? It was a very accessible tool watch. And a lot of people, and we've been doing good in the US market at that time. So, and a lot of people know us from that time. It's that generation who knows that from that time. We get a lot of, you know, service cases from that time. And we got very famous for Flieger and Official Cosmonaut and that kind of B42 cases and all of that. And from that, that was their, let's say, core product range, right? Those three things, right? And then after, then they did like side stories, side hustles, like experimental jumping hours and this and that and arts. And that's, I don't know what they all did, but there was that in 2012 for the 100th anniversary, there was the 150 Swiss franc quartz movement colors watch next to the 16,000 Swiss francs Daybreaker watch in the same window. Consumers won't understand what you're doing. So, and that's when we shifted it. Nowadays, it's, we're having a clear direction of what we want to be. And I mean, if you look at what kind of movements we use, the build quality, yes, of course, we said, hey, we cannot build this quality for the Fortis price of the 2000s. It's simply not possible, right? Especially if you build everything in Switzerland. So the thing is, we need to raise the prices, but what we do first is raise the quality. So, and we were standing at this, let's say, what you call this?
A fork in the road.
A fork on the road, where we said, okay, we could go down the cheap way, keep it cheap. You know, building watches for 2,000, 1,000, 1,500, or we could increase the quality immense and raise the prices with it. And then we made a decision and said, we need to build better quality for sure, because the other direction is going to be crowded by a million, let's say, small, very small micro brands. Celita brands, it's a nightmare to fight you through, right? And you don't earn any money with it, by the way. So we say, okay, if we want to, you know, build Fortis like a new ground base for the next generation to come, we need to go the other route and to build like probably one of the, if not the best tool watch in the world. That's our approach. So we did. So we're working with Kennessy. I mean, that's like the biggest, what do you call the knight thing, knighting of all times, that Kennessy allows you to use their movements based on the story you tell them, what you want to do with it. Because Kennessy says you only, I mean, there's only like 3, 4, 5 brands that can use Kennessy movements, right? Or are allowed to use Kennessy movements. And the reason to is they must love what you do with it. If they don't like what you do with it, you can pay as much as you want. You don't get it. And Jupp was there having a meeting with them. There were like 8 people popping into our rooms and saying, what's your plan for the brand? And Jupp told them what we're going to do. And they said, welcome to the club. like right away, same day. So, and I think that's something where someone who's out of this industry and has been working for this industry so long, right, tells you, yes, you're doing something completely right. So yeah, that's why I think it takes a lot of effort, time, money, sweat, tears, and blood to basically go down that route. But once you're at some point there, things will be awesome, right? Mm. And people will finally appreciate that Fortis is not a whatever brand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're going to.
Going back to earlier, you said you've been there for about 10 years now. Is that correct?
10 and a half, yeah.
What do you think you personally have brought to the brand?
Oh, I hate this question because you never say something about myself. I leave this to others, but I think it's not basically me who brought a lot to the brand. We are a team. That's always first and foremost. We have a team of 25 people in Grenchen. Then we have a, let's say, board team. That's 4 to 5 people, depending on how you count it. And there's, you know, what I love is, for example, Jupp, he's not taking decisions on his own, right? He's always asking me, Pascal, who's head of sales, Marcel, head of operations, and his wife. And that's basically the 5, let's say, decision takers at the end of the day. And yes, of course, I'm probably the most creative guy in the building, but creativity only doesn't make a dollar. So you need someone who is into numbers. You need to have someone who is into how to build their stuff. You know, it's a mixture of, you know, different facets of things someone can do or bring to the table. And then out of this grows something, I would say, close to perfect. Probably I'm more the creative side, but that wouldn't change anything without the rest.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that you make it a team thing. I think that's kind of been, it's been consistent with what you're saying. And I think that that'll resonate with a lot of our listeners here. You ready for some fun questions?
Oh yeah, always. Love that.
Let's start with, if you could only have one Fortis watch, what's it going to be?
Only one? I definitely go for the Vagabond. I'm traveling a lot. I do have 2 kids, I told you. And I definitely want to know if I can call them or if they're already sleeping or still sleeping. So for me, this is like one part of the new Fortis that is really, really new. It's something where a tool is not to tell you, oh, you have 60 seconds or your compression time is this and that. No, I don't even care about that shit. Can I call my kids? That's the most important tool function ever.
I like that. Before we do some more fun questions, that actually reminded me, let's talk just a little bit about that. And since you brought that up, what does the day-to-day look like for you?
Oh, yeah. Basically, I get up in the morning when I'm at home. I do have, my week is kind of split into 2 parts. I drive to Grenchen on Sunday evening because I have a little apartment in the top floor of the building. And I stay there until Wednesday. So my days there look pretty much work. I get up in the morning roughly at 7. I don't even set any timer. And I fall out of bed. I go to basically fall to the table. And at 11 a.m., every single day, we do have either a meeting or a call with the core team to see where we are. And depending on topics, it's going to take 5 minutes or 5 hours. Then from Wednesday afternoon to Friday, I am at home. This is here. And in the morning, I mainly bring my older son to the bus station for the school. Then I set up my coffee, go to the desk, have probably some calls, do some emails, and do whatever is needed or whatever is on the plan. And that's basically it. But I'm very free in my time. So you told me, I don't even give a shit if you're on a boat or on a golf course or wherever. as long as shit is getting done, it's getting done. It doesn't matter if you're working 2 hours or 18. I don't care.
You have children. How old are they?
Benny is 5 and Maximilian is 7.
Are they already getting into watches?
No, not yet. Not yet. I mean, they look at it, and Maximilian sometimes, when I grow older, I want to be like daddy. I want to work like daddy for watches and stuff. But yeah.
That's how it starts. Get them into watches so they don't have money for drugs.
I bought him a first watch, like a cheap one, luckily, because he lost it. like one for school and whatsoever, but like a flick flack. But yeah.
I think it's funny, you know, I have a 3.5-year-old little girl, and when we're doing bedtime, she wants to play with my watch. Mm. She's trying to rotate the dive bezel, or if I have a chrono, she's trying to push the pushers. And yep. She's always saying like, wow, daddy, you have a cool watch.
Yeah, fun thing about that is when I bring my kids to bed, I mean, they sleep in the parents' bed, and, you know, I take them like left and right, and I need to take off my watch. Otherwise they won't sleep because it's like glowing the hell out of the room. So they say, oh, your watch is glowing. Ba-da-da. So yeah, but I'll take me to take it off there.
All right. Back to fun questions. Are you a morning person or night owl?
More a morning person, I would say, but I can be a night owl too. I mean, it depends on, I mean, I grew up working in a media agency, so long days, and nights. Yeah, I'm basically used to whatever it needs.
Yeah, and that's something I'm sure a lot of our listeners know about, being military law enforcement. The hours can vary drastically. Yeah, this is, I give up a lot of sleep to do this podcast. And as we were mentioning off air, I'll just tell our listeners a story. We were at a wedding last night. The breacher on our SWAT team just got married, so congrats to him. He's also a watch nerd. We get home. It's already a little bit late. We get our kids down. The baby wakes up, so I'm dealing with that. And then our daughter woke up at 3:45, so I went in and I actually slept on the floor of her room to try to get her back down. But got to do what you got to do. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners know about that life. And you know, you're out of it now, but
I'm out of it now. 7 p.m. I'm done.
Next fun question. NATO strap, weather strap, or metal bracelet? What's your go-to?
Always bracelet. Sorry. NATO. I don't know what people want with NATO. You know, I mean, I understand the idea of it makes the watch lighter and everything, but it takes all the luxury out of a watch. It takes it all out. Immediate. You know, it's like there's a designer that I pay $1 million, basically, who designs a watch with a certain strap or a bracelet, and someone putting on a NATO, sorry for that, is just not respecting any kind of design. But I can agree on, I know that at some point people like that and they should do whatever they want.
That's funny. And I've never even considered that.
Yeah, yeah. Now you start, right? Now you put it back on the Horizon strap, please.
Let's get your horological hot take. What's something that a lot of people in the industry believe that you part ways with?
I mean, we're building tool watches. So my hot take is that every single watch should be scratched. Because if you only wear a watch kind of to show off, so probably the watch hasn't done much, right? In my opinion, scratches aren't any damage. It's basically proof of use. And I'm a big fan of scratches. You know, the first one is very painful. But then, you know, it's something where you know exactly what happened. This one, I knocked the door there. I had a couple too many drinks there, you know, that kind of stuff. I was doing hiking there and it happened this. So there's a lot of stories basically scratched into your watch if you look at it the right way.
And this resonates with our use your tools ethos, watches of espionage. If you follow him, he kind of coined that term. And that's something we certainly believe in Sketchy Boys Watch Club. That's a good one. I like that. I can't stand it when people hoard watches and they don't actually
Oh,
wear them
yeah.
because they don't want to hurt the resale value and they just keep
It's
them in their
never,
safe. What's the
but
point?
resale value. I mean, if someone says that, I mean, there's probably only three watches on the market that you might get that you maybe sell for more than you bought it in your lifetime, right? So don't fuck around with retail value and resale value and all of that. It's nonsense. Buy the watch, wear it, have fun, put some scratches in there, you know, take it through all your life, inherit it to your children, engrave it, whatever. That's the story. It's not the story about, oh, I need to take care of it because and polish it and bring it this and that and then bring it somewhere, Sotheby's, and maybe get a dollar back. Where's the point? Go buy some stocks if you want to invest.
I agree. What's the best feedback you've gotten from an end user on your watches?
Yeah, without telling other brand names, I mean, he says it's by far the best tool watch. And then there was one guy who, that was before Yop's time even, he was in the war of Iraq. And their transport got kind of attacked and a huge grenade kind of exploded and everything was a huge mess, you know, and he was digging through the stuff afterwards and there was his watch in his case molten, but the watch was still running. And he said, that's how far you could take it. It's like stories like that that we like very much. And there's people, one of the biggest compliments is always that we get quite a lot is, I mean, the coating is insane. The coating is insane. Is there a glass on the watch? I mean, it's like the best readable watch in the world. Stuff like that, right? Costly, but very well done.
All right. If you could add a crazy complication to a watch, what would it be?
A crazy complication. Ooh, good question. I mean, it's not too crazy, but I would love to maybe an Amadee, maybe the future Mars watch. Let's put it that way. The future Mars watch, that would be my complication go to have a GMT with Mars time and Earth time. So, which could be tricky because it's different times. So I think Mars has, I think, 24 hours and 47 minutes a day. So to match that somehow, I don't know, maybe that could be fun if there's like the first Mars station and they're all wearing like Forest watches and then they can check whether their parents at home, if they can call them or not, right?
Well, you heard it here. Future missions, the Mars mission. You heard
Yeah,
it here first.
I mean, that's why we do the Amadee missions, is like the preparation of that. We've been doing this now for 15 years or something already. And yes, of course, it's only analog Mars simulation missions, but it's very important, right? They do mistakes, and you don't want to do these mistakes up there. So, if ever the question comes up, we're flying to Mars next year, what kind of watch do we take? If they do a little bit of research, they should know which watch. Hashtag,
All right, favorite song.
Favorite song? I can't remember the name of the song. I'm really bad in this, you know, because I do like songs in general, right? I was a huge fan of the halftime show this year's American Super Bowl, but I also like classics and stuff. So there's no general song that I say that's my go-to song. My wife is very good in that. She has a playlist that she shares with me, luckily. So there's no specific song, but maybe David Bowie, probably. Just what's that song where it's talking about space? Gotta Google this.
Yeah. It's funny you bring that up. I think I actually happened to look up that specific song recently because I was looking to use it for an Instagram reel.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Starman. Yeah, you know Starman. But
Okay.
Heroes is also a very good song.
All right, favorite movie.
Interstellar. And on the other hand, I do really like Robin Williams in, I mean, the German name is Captain Hook. I don't know if what's the name in on English. Give me a second. Peter Pan.
It's funny you bring up Interstellar. We were just talking about that on the podcast I did with the astronaut. And my wife and I actually, my wife hadn't seen it before. So she and I watched it a couple weekends ago. That's such a good movie. I watched it.
Yeah, you need to watch it like five times.
Yeah. Until you... And you pick up something else every time you watch it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that movie is really a father-daughter story more than anything else.
No, absolutely. It's I mean the whole physical things going on there, you know, probably I guess only 1% ever kind of knows what's going to happen there. Mm-hmm. But the movie is very well done, right? So, and I like the idea of, I like it when I don't, you know, get the full story. Because I'm not capable of, you know, putting this into my brain. But yeah.
What is a question? So obviously this podcast, we have watch brands, but we also have a lot of end users, whether they're special operations guys or whoever. So you don't know who's the next guest, but what is a question you want me to ask them?
Faced with a real-world challenge, would you choose an iconic luxury watch or a no-compromise tool watch, and why?
All right. As we wind this down, there's two questions I like asking. The first is, if you could go back and give your 18-year-old self a lesson, what would it be? Or discuss a mistake that you've made to prevent your 18-year-old self from making, what would that be?
With the knowledge of today, I would probably say you don't need to change anything. It's going to come out good.
I love it when I get that answer.
Yeah, it's going to be fine.
Good. And the final question here, we've been talking now for a little bit. People have gotten to hear about you, about the brand. What is a takeaway or a life lesson that you hope that the listener of this podcast got out of hearing you talk?
I think one, I wouldn't call it lesson, but it's like, it sounds so much like a teacher, but it's like, don't always take the easy decision. Like, you know, everyone told me this is the best, but you know, there's more to explore. Maybe let's put it that way.
I like it. Well, where can people find out more about Fortis, or how can people get a hold of you if they want to do so?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, obviously, we do have a website, which is fortis-swiss.com. And you find us on Instagram at Fortis Watches Official. I don't know, something like that. You'll find it, the one with the crown. And more than happy I would be if they subscribe to our newsletter, because we're trying to send out a newsletter like every single week on a Friday. There's always some good stories or news or updates in there. If possible, I would love to grow our YouTube channel. We spent quite some money in doing very good videos, be it entertainment, be it info, be it, you know, new releases and that kind of stuff, talks. Love those talks. It's very nice to get more info about the brand. So yeah, subscribe to YouTube channel and to the mailing list, and don't miss out. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a great conversation, and I hope our listeners enjoyed getting to hear a little bit about the brand. Hopefully this puts Fortis on your radar if you weren't aware of this brand. There's a few members of Sketchy Boys that have been rocking Fortis's in some cool situations. So hopefully more people hear about the brand. And if this is something that resonates with you, if the work ethic and the mentality is something that you're into, check them out. As always, if you have feedback for me, reach out to me directly on Instagram, 9mm.mushi. And we will catch you all on the next one. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.